I'd like to invite all of you to turn with me in your Bibles to John chapter 18, please. John chapter 18, that's where we're going to be this morning. And so I'd like for us to turn there. I have a question I'd like to ask this morning for you to think about as we talk about this weekend and particularly what this weekend has meant to so many people over the years. And that question is very simply, where is it that faith leads you? Where does faith lead you? Imagine if there was somebody who didn't believe in Jesus or who didn't subscribe to Christianity or who wasn't a part of organized religion. They asked you, where's this whole faith thing going? What's the point of it? Why be a part of it? How would you answer that question? Now, what's interesting is that most Christians would say, well, faith leads toward heaven. And it leads this direction toward this eternal peace, happiness, level of serenity where there isn't conflict. And that's what faith is really getting at. And you would hear that and you'd say, oh, that sounds so nice. Faith leads to heaven, which leads to peace and constant just peace times and all sorts of joy. So where does faith lead you? The common answer that Christians would give to this question is it leads toward heaven. But how much does the question change if you just change it slightly and instead of asking where does faith lead you, ask the question, where has faith led you? Where has it led you in your life? Your faith, where has it pushed you to go toward? Where have you found yourself going because you have faith that if you did not have faith, you would not have gone before? And when you think about this story, this question shifts from a, well, what's ahead of us to a question of, well, what's your story? What's your testimony? Where has faith led you and what has it led you through each step of the way? Imagine if we could ask Jesus Christ this question. Jesus, tell us about where your faith has led you. How would he answer this question? Would he say, well, it's led me to eternal peace and happiness, and it led me to a great life here on earth where I didn't make anyone mad? Or would he give you quite a different answer? Because I believe that Jesus would give you a different answer. And to give you an idea of how different the answer would be, we're going to look at a story in John 18 that is prefaced and is led up to by a story that happens in John 11. And now in John 11, one of Jesus' friends dies. A man named Lazarus dies. Jesus then goes to the funeral. He weeps at the funeral. And then lo and behold, Jesus creates a miracle and he raises Lazarus from the dead. And he gets there and he raises Lazarus from the dead and everybody's just shocked, they're amazed. And as you can imagine, everyone was happy, right? Everyone was happy. Here is a guy who has been given life again. But if you keep reading the story, you're shocked to find that not everybody's happy. This idea of raising someone from the dead was actually quite controversial in Jesus's day and age. And you say to yourself, it was controversial. Who was it controversial with? And as you keep reading, you realize that there are people that are very angry about this, and the people that are very angry are the religious officials. And we read in John chapter 11, so from that day on, the day that Jesus gave the dead body life, the religious officials planned to put Jesus to death. Now, don't miss what's happening here. God gives the dead life, and immediately, religious leaders are filled with fear, suspicion, and violence. In other words, your religion can block you from experiencing the joy that God brings to earth. Imagine this for a moment. God gives life, and the religious institution's like, we can't have more of that. We can't have that. It's making too much of a mess of things. And they're so nervous about this that the next chapter is Jesus riding into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey, and there's a big crowd that shows up, and the religious leaders see all these people having a wonderful time, and the religious leaders say, oh no, we can't touch him now. You see, you can do nothing. Look, the world has gone after him. He is too popular for us to touch right now. What are we going to do? We have to put an end to his life. And so over the next several chapters, we hear about teachings of Jesus. Jesus has the Last Supper with his disciples. And after the Last Supper of his disciples, Jesus goes into the Garden of Gethsemane. And when he gets there, sorry, we'll go back just one second. Lost it. Anyways, that's what's going to happen. So eventually Jesus ends up in the Garden of Gethsemane. And that's where John chapter 18 unfolds. So I'd invite you to read that with me at this time. John 18:1 reads, "After Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley to a place where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, because Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas brought a detachment of soldiers together with police from the chief priests and the Pharisees. And they came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. And so we read, then Jesus, knowing all that was to happen to them, came forward and asked them, 'Who are you looking for?' They answered, 'Jesus of Nazareth.' Jesus replied, 'I am he.' Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, 'I am he,' they stepped back and fell to the ground. Again, he asked them, 'Whom are you looking for?' And they said, 'Jesus of Nazareth.' Jesus answered, 'I told you that I am he. So if you are looking for me, then let these men go.' This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, 'I did not lose a single one of those whom you gave me.' Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it, struck the high priest's slave, and cut his right ear. The slave's name was Malchus. Jesus said to Peter, 'Put your sword back into its sheath. Am I not to drink the cup that the Father has given me?' So the soldiers, their officer, and the Jewish police arrested Jesus and bound him. First they took him to Annas, and who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was better to have one person die for the people." So Jesus comes along, he's in the garden, and the religious police, the literal religious police, show up and they arrest him. And then they drag him to the high priest, a man named Annas, and they get there, and we're going to skip down just to John 18, verse 19, just a little bit further down the page, and we read what happens in front of the high priest. "Then the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered, 'I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard what I said to them. They know what I said.'" And so Jesus is basically saying, you know, what's the problem here? And in verse 22, it says, "When Jesus had said this, one of the police standing nearby struck Jesus on the face, saying, 'Is that how you answer the high priest?' Jesus answered, 'If I have spoken wrongly, testify to the wrong. But if I have spoken rightly, why do you strike me?' Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest." And so Jesus goes to Caiaphas, the high priest, who then sends him to Pilate, who is the Roman governor who oversees all of this. He is above all of the religious police, and the religious police function underneath the Roman government. And so eventually, Jesus makes his way to Pilate, and he gets there, and he's standing before him, and the religious police throw him before Pilate, and they say, "This man is a criminal." And as Pontius Pilate stands there, he's like, "All right, so what did this man do? What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they said, well, and I love their defense here. This is the religious police's defense. They say, "Look, we would not," hold on, it's coming, don't worry, it's going to be great. "If this man were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you." It's very clear, isn't it? We don't bring you non-criminals, just do something with him. And at this point, Pilate's like, "Okay, well, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. You know, if he's created a religious, or if he's broken a religious law, just give him the penalty for that law." And this is where the religious leaders get quiet, because they say, "Well, guess what? We need a favor from Rome, because we are not permitted to put anyone to death. And that's what we're looking for here." So here's Jesus standing before the Roman government. And the religion that he has been a part of his entire life, the synagogue that he has gone to week in and week out, the whole religious system that he has participated in and given his life to, is now saying, "You need to die. And we're not going to vouch for you. Instead, we're going to aggressively attack you." And if we were to ask Jesus in this moment, "Where has your faith led you?" what would he say? "Well, my faith led me to condemnation by the religious institution. That's right where it led me to. I lived by faith. I had more faith than any human before me, and it led me to direct condemnation by the religious institution." You'd say, "That's horrible, Jesus. How did that happen?" And then he would say, "But get this, that's not all, because it gets worse." Jesus then, is taken by Pilate aside. He's like, all right, I don't understand what the religious leaders want. They want to kill this man, and I'm not going to have this man's blood on my hands. So he pulls Jesus aside, and he talks to him directly. And Pilate says, your own nation, Jesus, and the chief priests have handed you over to me. What have you done? Like, what's the big deal here? And Jesus responds with a cryptic Jesus answer. And the response is, my kingdom is not from this world. If my kingdom were from this world, my followers would be fighting to keep me from being handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here. At this point, Pilate breathes a sigh of relief because he's like, oh, so you're a king. Because if you say that you're a king, then guess what? We can condemn you, we can execute you, and everything's fine. Jesus knows this, and so he doesn't answer that question that way. He says, well, you say that I'm a king. For this I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to my voice. And it goes to Pilate, and Pilate just says, what is truth? And we never get an answer. He goes back to the religious officials, and he says to them, he says, look, all right, how about we come up with a compromise? Every Passover, I find no case against him, but every Passover I release a prisoner from our establishment, from our prisons, and you can choose who you want. Do you want this man who's not gonna harm anybody? Why don't you just pick this man? And immediately the religious officials say, no, give us Barabbas, who's a hardened criminal. They say, give us Barabbas, that's what we want. And so at this point, Pilate's like, all right, these guys are angry, let's just appease their anger. Why don't we just beat the snot out of Jesus with floggings and make sure that they just like see how violent it is and maybe they'll calm down. So he has Jesus flogged. He then puts a crown of thorns on top of him, parades him in front of all of them, humiliates Jesus, and he says, is this not enough for you? And he says, here he is. Here's the man. Look, I am bringing him out to let you know that I find no case against him. This man's innocent. We've beaten him up. We're the state. We've capitulated to your demands. Is that enough for you? And immediately he says this, and the religious leaders say, well, you got to crucify him. And Pilate's like, why? What do I have to do here to like appease you people? And they say, well, crucify him. And he says, look, take him yourselves and crucify him. I find no case against him. And Pilate says this, and the religious leaders are like, no, we can't do that. Rome is the only one that can crucify him. So Pilate's like, all right, just tell me what the problem is. And then the religious leaders say, well, look, we have a law, and according to the law, he ought to die because he has claimed to be the Son of God. And Pilate says, all right, let me go back to Jesus and see if I can reason with him. So he says, look, where are you from? And Jesus is dead silent. And then Pilate says, don't you understand? Do you not know that I have power to release you and power to crucify you? I'm the one in charge here. You should be groveling to me. To which Jesus responds by saying, you would have no power over me unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin. And at this point, Pilate is insulted. And he gets angry according to John's gospel. And what happens next is he says, fine, you want it your way? Pilate then handed Jesus over to be crucified. And if we could go back and ask the question, Jesus, you're a man of great faith. You're the Son of God. Where has your faith led you? You know what his testimony would be at this point? My faith has led me straight to being condemned by the state. And what we so often forget as Christians is that Jesus, in his life of faith, in his life of radical love, faced condemnation not just from the religious institution, but also the state. The faith of Jesus led him to condemnation by church and state. You cannot separate one without the other in the story of Jesus. And yet Christians often miss this point. The faith of Jesus led directly to his condemnation by religion and by state. Which reminds me of another story. Back in 1954, the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama was looking for a pastor. And so they hired this young preacher from Boston who was 25 years old named Martin Luther King Jr. And in his first year, as pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, he organized the Montgomery bus boycott. That's not a bad first year to have. And what it was is there was this segregation. We all know the story of Rosa Parks and how she was asked by a white man to give up her seat. She refused. She was arrested. And immediately what happened was Martin Luther King and several other pastors from the area got everyone in the community together, all of the black community together, and they sat down and they said, hey, why don't we all stop riding the buses for a day? And so they said, okay. They stopped riding the buses for the day, and as you saw in the video, there was an amazing amount of carpooling, of coordination. The whole community came together. It was a great day for civil rights. And at the end of one day, they came together again. They said, well, what should we do now? Well, why don't we boycott the buses for another day? And another day. And another day. 381 days of bus boycotting. And it caught national attention, and the federal courts, the Supreme Court, came down and said, Alabama, you can no longer have racially segregated transportation. And they made it unconstitutional and illegal. And all of a sudden, this young preacher, 26 years old now, because it went for over a year, 26 years old, realized something. There was tremendous power in the church to bring about God's kingdom here on earth. And so Martin Luther King started to get a little bit of notifications, get a little bit of notoriety, and as people started to know who this person was, he started to get invitations to speak other places. Specifically, he caught the attention of a man named Billy Graham. Now, Billy Graham was a big deal, as you all know. And Billy Graham, he did evangelistic campaigns that are just unbelievable to read about today. This guy rented Madison Square Garden, and he sold it out for 68 straight days. 68. And he had an evangelistic campaign in Madison Square Garden for 68 straight days, and it looked like this. He invited Martin Luther King to speak at this and to give the prayer, and he and Billy Graham became fast friends. And they had dreams of one day working together, but as they started talking about working together, they realized they had different objectives. Billy Graham wanted to talk about strictly religious things and stay away from politics, and Martin Luther King wanted to use his faith to bring about change and bring about the kingdom of God here on earth now. And so they decided they couldn't work together. Now, they didn't end up being enemies. They just figured out they couldn't work together. But it was here that Martin Luther King in Madison Square Garden looked around and said, imagine if all of these people actually believed that every person in America was God's child and therefore deserved every bit of equal rights. How would that change things? And so he was disappointed when it didn't work out with Billy Graham, but then he looked at his own church. He looked at the National Baptist Convention, and he said, wait a second, we got more people in the National Baptist Convention than in all of Madison Square Garden. There were 5 million members, 20,000 preachers, and it was the largest black religious body in America. And he said, man, imagine if we could get this whole denomination to go and make some change and get together and say, you know what, we're going to fight for civil rights together because this is the kingdom's work. This is what God is about. The only problem was there was a movement within the National Baptist Convention that said, we don't want to get involved in politics. This was headed up by a man named Joseph Jackson, and he was the president of the National Baptist Convention. But Martin Luther King was relieved because in 1957, he had to step down because he could only serve 4 years maximum as president, as outlined by the bylaws. So Martin Luther King went to the 1957 National Baptist Convention, the annual session in Kentucky. He went there, and he was excited because he was going to campaign for a new president that would make civil rights the priority of the National Baptist Convention. And so right before the vote happens, Joseph Jackson hears about all of this, and he says, not in my watch you'll have that happen. And he has one of his lieutenants stand up and say, we need to change the bylaws and allow Dr. Jackson to serve as long as God sees fit. There was a second, there was an immediate vote, and all of a sudden, Joseph Jackson became the president for another year. Now, after he became president again, Martin Luther King was shocked because according to Taylor Branch, who wrote about this, Jackson immediately consolidated power and discouraged churches from active involvement in civil rights, pushing the church toward conservatism, and said, we're not going to get involved in that. And so Martin Luther King went away defeated because he said, oh, there are so many people here and we can make a major change. And he said, we're going to change this. And he got him and several other pastors that he was working with through the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. They got together and they said, how can we change this? And as they started to talk, they came up with a plan over the next 3 years, and they were going to change things in 1960. 3 years later, they were scheming this plan to take over. Oops, excuse me. They were scheming this plan to take over the National Baptist Convention and win a Democratic election and make it so that this was a priority. So they get there, and as I read about this, I was shocked because it sounds exactly how you would expect church politics to go. Because what happened was Jackson received word that they were doing this, so he said, we need to show that we're together on this because unity is the most important thing. And so he walks in with all of his voters at the same time, which were in the thousands. Now, Martin Luther King knew he couldn't run for president because he was too young. He was only 28 or 9 at this point. And so he had a friend, Gardner Taylor, who was one of the greatest orators of all time. He was up in New York. And they said, we're going to make him president, and he'll put civil rights at the priority of this. And so they knew that Jackson's people were going to walk in there and say, this is the right president. We're going to walk in together. But the Taylor people said, why don't we rent bass drums from marching bands? And they went and they rented 2 bass drums from marching bands. And when they came in, they said, we're not going to be intimidated. And they started banging on those bass drums as they came into the convention hall. They said, we're here. Boom, 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 boom. And they said, we're going to vote for Taylor. Now, as soon as they came in, they said, look, we're not supposed to vote for president several days from now, but we want to vote right now. To which Jackson said, sure, let's vote right now. Now, at this point, the Taylor supporters were very surprised. Why is it that Jackson would allow this vote? This was not like Jackson, according to what they knew. But Jackson then said, how about Kansas? Why don't you tell us who you would vote for? The incumbent, me, or would you vote for Gardner Taylor as president? Now, this was a big surprise because the Taylor supporters assumed that Kansas was going to vote for Gardner Taylor. But the people from Kansas stood up and said, we vote for Jackson because he is the only one of us qualified to be president. Now, this threw the auditorium into chaos. Immediately, there were shouts of no and yes on one side or the other. People started chanting, we want Jackson, we want Taylor. The bass drums started going. Taylor Branch even talks about how there were 3 people on a piano banging as much as they could to try and make noise. And he said this went on for 5 hours. 5 hours. And you may say it can't go on for 5 hours. Yes, there were some breaks. And the only way they could have some breaks is if a Philadelphia police officer restored enough order for the delegates to join in singing Glory in His Name and Oh Lord, Stand By Me. So songs were the only thing that could stop everybody from keep going on this thing. So they got up there, they were singing the songs, but as soon as they started talking about business, it was pandemonium. Reporters that day talk about how they were standing 6 feet away from Jackson in the front row, and they couldn't even hear a word he was saying. It was so loud. So eventually, after 5 hours of just noise, Jackson says, I'm calling a silence on this whole thing, and I'm leaving. So he left. The problem is no one could hear him. So people thought the vote was still on. And so Jackson's supporters said, let's take a vocal vote. And they took a vocal vote, and it was clearly in favor of Jackson, but it wasn't official. So all the Jackson supporters left, and there was just the Taylor supporters only left in the auditorium. So the Taylor supporters said, why don't we take an official vote? And so they did. And it turned out that it was 1,800 votes for Gardner Taylor and 500 votes for Jackson. And everyone's like, oh, okay. And this is where the crucial point, Martin Luther King, after seeing these votes, stands up and says, I nominate Gardner Taylor for president of the National Baptist Convention. Now at this point, guess what happens? Word gets out to the Jackson supporters that Taylor's been elected. So they come back in screaming, hooting, hollering, and eventually the people from Philadelphia, the police department from Philadelphia, have to come in and shut off the lights because they're like, we've had enough. We're done with this. The rest of the convention's canceled because nobody's sure who's actually president, and it goes to the courts, and the courts keep bouncing it around. Nobody wants to make this decision because they feel like they need to have separation of church and state. So the 1960 National Convention ended with no presidents selected. So we waited until the 1961 National Baptist Convention. This is where it gets really interesting because there was 2 sort of presidents coming to this place. And there was this fear that the Jackson supporters would block the Taylor supporters from getting on the stage. And so they said, we've got to get Gardner Taylor on the stage because he's the rightful president. So I'm not making this up. They came up with this plan that they were going to form a flying wedge. And if a flying wedge sounds familiar, it's because you've seen it in a movie several years later called The Flying V from the Mighty Ducks. And they're going to come up with this wedge, and they're going to fight and push Gardner Taylor to the stage because he's the rightful president. So they push, they go in there, they push, they do the flying wedge, they get as close as they can. But the problem is Jackson's supporters are all around him. So they say, sorry, you can't go any further. And a real scuffle breaks out. In the midst of the scuffle, and this is where the story turns tragic, there's an old reverend, Reverend Wright, who's pushed off the stage. He fractures his skull. He's rushed to the hospital, but he shortly after that dies. At this point, the Kansas City Police Department says, enough. We're going to run your elections in your church business meetings. And so they come in, and they say they're going to run this and see how it goes. And there's all sorts of chaos. There's all sorts of wondering whether they should go down this road or not. And they finally take a written vote. And the vote is 2,700 votes for Jackson, 1,500 votes for Gardner Taylor. Jackson is the unquestionable president at this point, and he does not forget or forgive very easily. He looks right at Martin Luther King, the man who nominated Gardner Taylor, remember, and sees his title, the vice president of Sunday School Board, who set all the Sunday school curriculum for the National Baptist Convention, and said, that title is gone. He did it immediately. At this point, Martin Luther King turned to Gardner Taylor and says, can you believe that he just did that? And Gardner Taylor said, that's the new way things are going. At the end of the day, there was a press conference. And Jackson went to the press conference, and he immediately blamed all that happened on King. Even though it was much more people, he said, Martin Luther King is the real problem here. His exact words were, the method of campaign for the presidency was due largely to Brother King. His backers marched in boldly and took over the convention. This disregard for convention officers and the pushing of folks off the platform was the result of an election campaign so vicious, it produced violence. Now, if you know anything about Martin Luther King, you know that his whole life was nonviolence. And yet, here's the president of his church saying, oh, that's a violent man. But he didn't leave it alone. Because at the Reverend Wright's funeral, the one who had died in the scuffle, he keeps talking about passive-aggressively how bad Martin Luther King was. And he said these words at the funeral. He said, the disrespect for the law and the move for freedom has opened the way for criminals to come to their midst. Too many preachers have the cloth on the outside but don't have the gospel on the inside. There are hoodlums and crooks in the pulpits today. Now, at this point, King realizes that he is lost and that his church is against him. So he has to leave. And he and several other civil rights leaders start the Progressive National Baptist Convention and step out from the church that they have called their home for their entire lives. At this point, if we could go back to Martin Luther King and say, tell me, Martin, where has your faith led you? What would he say? Well, my faith inspires me to fight for freedom for all, he would say. And he would say something like this, my faith led me to my church blaming me for a violent murder I did not commit at a time when I'd been thrown in jail and beaten over and over again for refusing to participate in violent actions. Not only that, but my faith led me to my church ostracizing me and my family because we believed it should stand against the injustice of racism. My faith led me to condemnation by the church. That's exactly what happened. So you want to talk about faith and where it's led me? It's led me to being condemned by the church. And you say, that's awful. I can't imagine that. And you'd say, oh, but that's not all. Because there's so much more. There was a time just in 1963, that then Martin Luther King set his sights on a city of Birmingham, Alabama. And he set his sights on this city because it was at the forefront of his mind because he called it the most segregated, probably the most thoroughly segregated city in America. To give you an idea of how segregated Birmingham was, it had a population of 350,000 people, 40% of which were black. And yet when you look at the way and the employment broke, you realize how segregated it was. There was no black police officers, no black firefighters, no black bank tellers, and no black cashiers. And so he went there and he demonstrated all sorts of protests, and they were always filled with nonviolence. They were always direct action, but they were always in a peaceful manner, and it eventually wound him up in jail. And it was while he was in this Birmingham jail in 1963 that he wrote one of his most famous letters called Letter from a Birmingham Jail. And he wrote it in response to the church community that kept criticizing him, saying, why do you need your ego to be filled so you can get on newspapers and go and fight for civil rights? Just leave well enough alone. Trust the government to fix things. So he writes this letter, and it's one of the best pieces of American literature ever written. And in it, he writes, I'm in Birmingham because injustice is here. That's why I'm here. It's not for my ego. It's because there's injustice here. And then he writes, like Paul, I must constantly respond to the Macedonian call for aid. If there is injustice happening somewhere, Christians should go there. He keeps going, I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And you say, wow, it must be rough to be in that jail trying to write those things. But Martin Luther King at this point was comfortable with jail because this was his 13th arrest. And over the next 5 years, because he was assassinated in 1968, he'd be arrested another 16 more times. And it's hard to believe that he writes that letter from a Birmingham jail, and then 4 months later, he has the biggest moment of his life. As part of a march on Washington with 250,000 supporters, he gives his I Have a Dream speech, which everyone knows to this day. And it's an amazing speech, probably the greatest speech given in American history. And the FBI was listening to that one, and they heard it. And immediately on that day, in response to it, there is a memo that they have found from the FBI that is official work of the FBI. And on the memo, it says, in response to this speech, Martin Luther King Jr. is the most dangerous and effective Negro leader in the country. And they started saying these rumors because they needed to take care of King because he was threatening the FBI's power. So they said, well, I think he's a communist, and he has communist sympathies. So we need to make sure that we know that he's not a communist. So they went to Attorney General Robert Kennedy, and they said, we'd like to bug his home and track Martin Luther King all the time to make sure he's not a communist. And on October 10, 1963, Attorney General Robert Kennedy authorized the FBI to wiretap King's home. But he gives a caveat, and he makes it very clear. He's like, I'll let you do this, but make sure that the FBI didn't get caught while you're tapping his home. Just make sure that happens. And so he does this. They go and they tap his home, and over the next year, they start collecting all of this information on him illegally. And when they do it, when they get all of this information, what happens is they start to make all these claims about Martin Luther King. And J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI forever, basically said that Dr. King is the most notorious liar in the country. And then he had criticized King's group, the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, by saying, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is spearheaded by communist and moral degenerates. This is not just anybody saying this. This is the FBI, the head of the FBI. And after a year of investigating him, the FBI eventually, on his 34th birthday, placed Martin Luther King to full enemy status. They placed this on him. Martin Luther King had staked his life and his religion on the chance that enemy thinking might one day be overcome. And yet here he is, an enemy of the FBI. And when you're marked as an enemy of the FBI, they don't come to your aid when death threats show up. Because shortly after this, a death threat arrives at Martin Luther King's door, and it's called the suicide letter. And it's written to Martin Luther King saying, you better commit suicide in 34 days, or else everyone will know everything about you. And to give you an idea of what the language of this letter is, it's simply like this. In view of your low-grade, abnormal personal behavior, I will not dignify your name with either a mister or a reverend or a doctor, and your last name calls to mind only the type of king, such as King Henry VIII, and his countless acts of adultery and immoral conduct lower than that of a beast. Listen to yourself, you filthy, abnormal animal. There's only one thing left for you to do. You know what it is. Take your own life. This was sent on November 21, 1964. King was assassinated in 1968, And in 1971, people found out, they found evidence that they knew who sent this anonymous letter, and it was the FBI. They sent it to him after declaring him an enemy, knowing that they couldn't protect him and knowing they had to threaten him. So, if we looked at Martin Luther King and said, "Tell me, Martin, where has faith led you?" He would say, "Well, my faith led me to being arrested 29 different times. My faith led me to being labeled as a national enemy of freedom in a country founded on freedom, even though I fought my whole life for freedom. My faith led my country to wiretap my home because they feared I was a communist. And when the FBI couldn't prove that I was a communist, they used that illegally acquired information to blackmail me and demand that I commit suicide. Where has my faith led me? My faith has led me to be condemnation by the state." And when you look at who Martin Luther King was and someone that we celebrate on a weekly basis or on a yearly basis, you have to understand something about Martin Luther King. During his lifetime, when he was alive, in this nation that celebrates him every year, Martin Luther King was condemned by both church and state. And when you compare and contrast the life of Jesus and the life of Martin Luther King, yes, Martin Luther King, of course, has sin, and he's not the Son of God, and we're not supposed to place him on the same pedestal, but when you talk about where their faith led him, it was to very similar places. And when you look at the fact that they were condemned both by church and by state, you start to say to yourself, wait a second, were they actually outlaws? Because murderers are in the same category as them. What's different than from murder from what they did? Well, they were on the other side where it wasn't radical hatred of another, but radical love. And I think the story that we can take from Jesus and Martin Luther King is very, very easy to understand and very, very hard to do. And that is quite simply, love threatens power. And if you look at who Jesus was really hard on in his days, during his life, when he walked this earth, it was people who abused power over and over and over again. When you look at the people who really went after Martin Luther King, day after day after day, it was people that had something to lose. And the people he was struggling with were the people who were abusing power. And if you commit yourself to radical love in 2017 today, you will find that it will actually threaten power. That's what it does. It exposes the corruption of anyone who abuses power over and over again. And when you look at their lives and the fact that they were condemned both by church and by state, and you ask yourself, well, where is faith supposed to lead you? And you say, well, it leads me to heaven and peace and serenity. You say, really? Does it? Because it seems that this was the opposite direction for them. Now, either they didn't have the right faith or we have a bad understanding of what faith actually is. Because these two committed their lives to love. And not just any kind of love, but radical, changing, heart-aching, bleeding love. And it threatened power wherever they went. In one of my favorite sermons of Martin Luther King's, he writes, it's called A Tough Mind and a Tender Heart. He says these words, and I think they're a challenge to Christians everywhere today. The words are, we must learn that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system, and thereby to become a participant in its evil. Now, what does this have to do with us today? You may say to yourself, so do I need to lead a march on Washington to follow Jesus? No. No. But everywhere around you, there are injustices happening. Whether it's injustices of racism, sexism, homophobia, or xenophobia. And the story of Martin Luther King Jr. and Jesus Christ is a story that says you do not passively accept those injustices. To passively accept it and say, well, I just hope they don't come after me, is to participate in that evil. And so if you are in the workplace and you notice that women are getting paid less than men, it is your responsibility as a Christian to stand up and say, this must stop. If you are out on an airplane and there is an Arab man being let off the airplane because he was speaking Arabic, you have a responsibility as a Christian to stand up and say, why is he being let off this airplane right now? you just spoke Arabic? That doesn't seem like it's enough. When you talk about what it means to be a Christian in 2017, it means that when you see this discrimination happening still, I mean, this wasn't that long ago, against people of different skin colors, you stand up and you say, this must stop. Yes, you may be condemned by the state. Yes, you may be condemned by the church, but that is the Christian journey. That is where Christianity is calling us. And it's not big marches that happen over, you don't have to coordinate all that stuff. You just have to participate and be open to seeing it and say to yourself, I can fight injustices around me wherever I am today. Why? Because we must learn that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system and thereby to become a participant in its evil. It is not enough to sit down and say, well, let's just keep the peace. We must stand up and with nonviolence say, we cannot have that here. May we be filled with that love that threatens power. May we commit our lives to it, and may we follow in the footsteps of Jesus, the footsteps that were condemned by church and by state. Amen.